very much. On the piano, ladies and gentlemen, from Nashville, Tennessee, Shane Keister. Beethoven. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Come on, wait a minute.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. On this episode, we speak to Shane Keister, a man who has worked with the likes of Elvis Presley, Elton John, Roy Orbison, Paul McCartney, Emmylou Harris, Tom Jones, Celine Dion, Joe Cocker, Johnny Cash, and the legendary Stax trio of Steve Cropper, Donald Duck Dunn, and Al Jackson Jr. As a keyboardist, arranger, and producer, Shane has appeared on numerous records which have garnered international acclaim, and Shane has twice been nominated for Grammys for his contribution to the music industry. Today, Shane joins us via live feed from his home in Nashville, where we'll be giving an insight into touring with Elvis, recording at the legendary Stax Studios, his love of the Mini Moog, and what he has learned from collaborating with such musical greats over the years. It's a pleasure to have you with us today, Shane. How's it going?
Thank you. I'm doing great, Chris. Thanks for the interest in my career.
Fantastic. So you've had an extraordinary career, and I'd like to begin right at the start. We have a lot of listeners who are music students in schools or at colleges who have ambitions to pursue the kind of career that you've experienced. I know that you had you started playing the piano at the age of about three, and you had a lot of classical training and that kind of thing. At what stage was it that you thought, hang on, I can actually turn this into a career?
I think it was about the time that I got into a junior high school. In our school years, we went grades 1 through 6, and then we went to a junior high school, grades 7 through 9, and high school from grades 10 through 12. And in my junior high years, I joined a swing band, a stage band, a full horn section and a rhythm section. And we started playing, we played for school events, of course, but when we played out, they would pass the hat, or sometimes we'd give contributions, and all of a sudden I see money coming in from music. Hey, what an interesting idea.
Excellent. And so did you have any specific ambitions at that age? What kind of age would that have been, roughly?
I was 12 and 13 and 14.
Wow.
I was very blessed to have great teachers that encouraged me to be diverse in music. And my career, at that point, I was planning to be a concert pianist. My piano teacher was encouraging me, and God gave me a great gift, so that's what I was pursuing. That quickly changed over the next couple of 3 years as I found rock and roll and jazz and commercial music, and I became a lover of all kinds of music.
Fantastic. And I think I've read that it was kind of the Beatles, like many, many people, it was the Beatles when they came along that really kind of captured your imagination. Is that right?
Oh, the Beatles. The Beatles got my attention right away. Contemporary music, of course, then, the Beatles were probably at the forefront of it, but there were so many groups, especially from England, as you know, that influenced American music. And then our music, was trying to, we were playing catch-up for a while, and then we kind of caught up and led for a while, and it's gone back and forth over the decades. But, the radio, especially, I listened a lot to the radio. I never had before until I was about 14 or 15, and I started listening to AM radio.
And how did your family react to that, given that at first they expected you to go into become, a concert pianist doing classical music? How did they react to that?
Well, my mom was quite concerned because she was a pianist, and mothers always want the best for their children. But my grandfather, her father, was a musician and a teacher, and he understood. He played vaudeville shows and stuff like that, so he completely understood. He was sympathetic. He didn't encourage me to be wild and leave, but he encouraged me to pursue my dreams. But I got very interested in studio work. There was several companies in Dallas in those years doing library music for radio stations, and they would hire musicians independently and call us, and I quickly learned that in about 1.5 to 2 days of work in the studio, I could make what I could make in a week of working in a nightclub. Plus, the hours were far less. So, something here. What's this studio musician thing? And that was a term that I barely was familiar with at that point, but I understood from that, you know, what it would entail. And I thought, well, I could live a normal life and not have to travel and live out of a suitcase if I don't play in front of 30,000 people. That's okay. I kind of changed my whole goal right there.
And again, so what age was that? What specific age was that? Were you in late teens then?
About 19, almost 20, yeah.
That's great. And I suppose having the early lessons and the tutorship when you were very young must have given you so much confidence for, technically, knowing that you could take on most things.
Yes. Then most of what I was doing was notated. I would show up for a session, and there would be a lot of notated passages, but there would be chord symbols, you know, or various, you know, shortcut symbols that we use in music. And I already knew those from working in, you know, like I said, I was in 7th and 8th grade in a jazz band, and of course there's not a lot of notation in that music. Sometimes there is. And I'd been reading notation since I was a child, but symbols, you know, chord symbols were something that were pretty unknown except to those people that, you know, read jazz charts, you know, and things like that. So I was comfortable reading just about anything that anybody would put in front of me.
Is it right that you were the only person you kind of knew who owned a Leslie speaker as well? Is that right?
Oh, yes. I was encouraged early on by some guys. The bands that I was in, I was always the youngest guy in the band, you know. So most of the guys were 4 or 5 years older than me. And they told me about this fantastic speaker called a Leslie. And they tried to describe how it sounded. And you can describe it all you want, but you can't really tell how it sounds until you hear it. I can't remember where it was that I heard the first one. So I grew up in Portsmouth, Ohio, in Huntington, West Virginia, so it would have been one of those two areas. And I was blown away. Oh, my gosh, this was just a complete revelation in sound, you know, swirling, chorusy. I had to have one. So I bought one very early on with a Fender Contempo organ, which is sort of like a Farfisa Fender's version. I think this was probably about 1966, maybe 65. But anything, as you probably know, you could put a guitar through a Leslie and it sounds like a Leslie. It's the Leslie itself that sounds with the Doppler effect. So,
well, I think it was the Beatles when John Lennon put his vocals through it as well, didn't they?
Yeah,
as well?
Exactly.
I think that's how they got the backing vocals on Octopus's Garden to make them sound like they're underwater and stuff like that. That's my understanding.
Yeah, the Doppler effect. I decided to move to Memphis. I had done a rock and roll project for Stax, about a year before I moved. It never came out. I was in a rock and roll band, and it was one of the records that was just signed, you know, because we were a good band, but it was never released. But I had had the joy and pleasure of working in the Stax studio.
Tell us about that. Tell us about that experience.
Well, that was with a rock and roll group called the Southwest FOB. And there were four of us that went to, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, I think, I can't remember if there were 6 of us or 4 of us in the band at that point, but we spent a couple of weeks in Memphis and made a record, and it was, I don't remember the quality of it, I just remember musically, it was pretty crazy, you know, when you get a bunch of young musicians in to do their first recording, everybody plays everything that you know, which is all wrong. You don't play everything you know for a record. You leave space, but I don't remember the record being incredibly rewarding, but it was the first record that I had ever done, and that was the reward of it, you know, to hear it back. Then I went, and that was, I think that was probably 1968, I can't remember, but I went back to Dallas and went back to school. That was still my goal at that point, so I remembered Memphis being, you know, a good feeling. You know, I had played around some clubs too, you know, jammed around with some bands when we were there. And I remember I had a really good feeling about Memphis, so I moved back to Memphis. I moved to Memphis. I hadn't lived in Memphis until then. And I think that was about 1970, early 1970. Moved there on a whim, you know, saved up a little money, pulling a U-Haul trailer with a car, you know, typical. And, got an apartment, and there was a pizza parlor about 2 blocks from our house, our little apartment. And I said, you know, they always have a a guy playing stride piano in a pizza place. Let me go down and see if they got one there. And sure enough, I walk down, here's a pizza parlor, you know, with a guy playing stride piano. Well, I did some of that in college. So I thought, oh, I got this gig, you know. And I walked up to the owner and I said, the manager, and I said, hey, do you need another piano player? And he went into this heartfelt story about, well, this guy comes in, you know, with his family two or three nights a week, and I have to feed his kids, you know, and he's been working here for 2 years, and he won't, you know, he gave me this story. I just felt so sorry for this guy. I was about to displace this guy. I just couldn't do it. So the manager looked at me and said, do you play piano? And I lied, and I said, no, but do you need a cook? And he said, yeah, I can always use a cook. So I started cooking pizza, but I didn't have to cook pizza very long, about 2 or 3 weeks, because right across from our apartment was a nightclub that I worked in 5 nights a week with a band, and also played cocktail piano from 5 to 7. It was a restaurant, and that's where I saw Jim. It was Jim Stewart in there one night.
And tell us how that relationship developed and how that helps your career.
I consider that probably the very beginning, although I had done some sessions, like I said, in studio work in Dallas, but not many, probably 20 or 25 sessions altogether, you know, for library folks and for a couple independent artists. But I saw Jim. I was playing cocktail pianos, you know, five or six in the afternoon, and I recognized Jim with a client. So I waited until the client left, and I walked over to the table and introduced myself. He said, oh, yeah, I remember you. He said, would you like to come to the studio tomorrow? And I said, oh, yeah, what's going on? He said, well, I'm not hiring you. He said, but we have a session on the emotions in the morning at 10 o'clock, and if you'd like to come to the session and be my guest and, you know, stay in the control room and watch, I'm like, oh, gosh, are you kidding? So I was there at 10 o'clock in the morning. And there on the floor is Al Jackson Jr., Duck Dunn, Steve Cropper, Bobby Manuel, Spark Horns, the girls, you know, the emotions, and everybody except Marvell Thomas. Marvell was late that morning. He was almost 2 hours late.
And was the keyboard player, is that right?
Yeah, because Booker had left the section, had left to go. I think he was producing Bill Withers' record at that part.
Right, right.
I know he was no longer an official part of the section, but, you know, he was obviously an integral part, but he chose production for a while, so Marvell had been playing, and Marvell was late that morning. Well, then there were no demos, you know. There was printed music, and if the act didn't play an instrument, they would show up and they would know the lyrics and the melody, of course. But if they didn't play an instrument, you know, guitar, piano, or something, there was no way to know what the chords were other than to read the chords. Mm. And for those folks that don't read chords, there was no way to learn the music, right? So Jim waited till about 10:30. And said, look, you know, Marvell's going to be late, and we need to get this going. Could you teach them? Do you read music, Shane? I said, oh, yeah. He said, can you teach the band the song? I said, sure. So I, you know, walked out the piano and started playing this chord, two beats of this chord, et cetera, et cetera. And somebody said, hey, this sounds good. Let's count it off. And let's cut this thing, you know, or whatever. And that was it. And they used both of us from then on.
Vietnam, baby's over there, and my friends are wondering, ooh, wondering why I don't go nowhere. Well, if you're one of them, I still love you, and I'm going on strike till my baby comes back. Ooh, all night parties and imitations.
That actually began with you approaching someone. So rather than waiting as a musician who'd been playing, you waited till the client had left and you approached them rather than being approached. And if that hadn't have happened,
my destiny probably would have been different. But, you know, what I learned even then, what I knew, I don't know who taught me this, is, you know, being quiet and waiting for the right time in the right place is probably as important as anything. Because I have to believe, had I gone up while that client was with Jim, It could have gone the other way. Jim would have said, hey, yeah, Shane, good to see you. Have a good life. You know, I'm busy. But your point is well taken, yes.
And tell us, how long were you recording with Stax or at Stax Studios for? How many sessions did you do? Was it quite a long period, or was it?
Better part of a year, Chris, probably 10 months or so. I don't know how many sessions, a couple of three sessions a week, I guess. I don't know how many that would be over a period of 8, 10 months probably I was there. And I probably would have continued to be part of that section, except I met Chip's Moment, and Chip's hired me exclusively to work for him.
Fantastic.
When I was working with Stax, I could work for anybody. It was just, you know, if are you busy next Tuesday? If you're not busy Tuesday, you've got a session. You know, and if you are busy, we'll book somebody else. It was Chip's hired me exclusively for his section.
Fantastic. Just going back to working with the likes of Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn and Al Jackson, I remember where I was and what I was doing when I first saw the footage of Al Jackson playing drums. And I was actually quite a latecomer to Stax. I was about 27 years old at the time. I'm now nearly 32. And I remember thinking, gosh, I've been watching drummers for the last 16, 17 years, and I've never seen someone look so natural and so effortless in their drumming technique.
Yeah.
And so many drummers I must have seen would have practiced to, you know, to wearing down the palms of their hands, you know, trying to get to the technique and the level of mastery that he had. Yet he did it so effortlessly. And I wonder what it was like working with him, and how did he differ compared to other drummers you've played with?
Well, he was a great mentor to me. I remember the very first time I ever tried to play a 12-8 arpeggio, boom, doom, doom, boom, doom, boom. You know, 12-8, where either the guitar or the piano, the right hand of the piano or the guitar is arpeggiating. And this song had come in, and that's what the accompaniment was. And I was playing all the right notes, and I was playing the right tempo. But Al, when Al was comfortable, you're right, it was effortless. He would sit back, and he would lift his shoulders and smile and just sit there like this, right? And he just barely moved, but the music just flowed out of him, right? But on this song, he was leaning over, and you could see he was making an effort, right? And we played it for maybe a couple of minutes or whatever, and he finally put his sticks down, and he walked over to me. He was like a big brother to me. He walked over, and he said, "Shane, get up from the piano." So I got up, and he sat down, and he put his hands on the piano. And he didn't really play piano. He knew a little bit, but he knew what he wanted to communicate to me. He said, "Okay, put your hands on top of my hands." I put my hands on top of his hands, and he said, "Now feel this." And he started playing the 12-8, I think probably a different key or whatever, but he was playing a feeling. And he said, "Can you feel what I'm doing?" And it felt different and sounded different than what I was doing. I said, "Yes." He said, "Can you do that?" I said, "Yeah, I think so." He said, "Well, then play it and stop playing like a white boy. Play it." I was like, "Yeah, I get it." And he went and picked up his sticks, and it just something that I learned to do from him, you know.
Wow.
I understood what he meant.
Such a great man, and so sad that he passed away at such a young age as well.
He was an amazing man.
And what about Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn?
I did know Steve. I did not know Steve and Duck. Steve, of course, is still here. But I did not know either one nearly as well as Duck. But when you're working on a session, as you know, things get pretty intimate, you know, because you're in your musical underwear, you know, when you're recording. And I just remember really liking the feeling of I was blessed to work with such amazing musicians when I was so young. But I remember liking the feeling that I got from everybody. It was a team effort. There wasn't any one person that stuck out. You know, there was always a leader, of course, but it wasn't that person was any better than anybody else. It was just somebody had to make the decision about this is what we do here, and we all had input into it. You know, we all had to discuss things like a band does. You know, about the verse should be, or the chorus should be, or maybe the bridge should be. But I always got a great feeling of being welcomed by those folks. I never got any bad feelings.
So you had quite a creative outlet. At that time, you weren't being dictated to by the producer or a particular person?
Not dictated in that sense, but definitely guided, because, you know, the producer's responsible for the record, basically. He gets blamed if there's anything wrong. So it's his job to kind of unobtrusively steer the boat, you know. And usually, you know, when you put a band together with a talented artist in a good studio with a good engineer and everybody can hear, things kind of take care of themselves, you know. And if you want to do something special with a part of the song or with, you know, with the song itself, that's when you get specific. But I was always used to taking directions, and I like being directed. You know, I've always liked that. You know, people are there to make something that's genuine. A bad vibe in a recording studio usually doesn't happen a second time, you know. I remember, like I said, very few times that the vibes weren't always positive. Even when there's, you know, a problem with tempo or a key or an arrangement or something like that, everybody knows that we're there to make a record. You know, however we get the record made, it doesn't matter as long as it's the record that the producer and the artist want, you know. So it's always a team effort, yes.
Great. And tell us about the Junior Farm sessions in 75. How was that playing with the Beatle, given how much they influenced you as a child?
I was tremendously influenced by their music as a child, you know. Everything from, I think I got my first kisses on the first girl I ever kissed was to a Beatles song.
Which song was that?
I think I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it was. I Want to Hold Your Hand. But yeah, I played their music on stage and loved to play their music on stage. So when I got called for this, McCartney, I knew, you know, everybody in Nashville had heard that McCartney had been in town for a while. And I got the call at the last minute. I think it was 11:30 or 12 o'clock in the afternoon. And the phone rang, and it was the secretary for the studio. And the session had just come up all of a sudden like that. And could I do it? And I was like, it doesn't matter whether I got anything. I'll be there. I did not have anything, but I would have canceled anything to do the session, right? And that was the first session, and to my memory, still the only session that I was nervous on, Chris. It was, and it wasn't because of Paul or Linda. They were just genuinely wonderful people. In fact, I have Linda doodled some art on the back of my chord chart that I still have. She drew a little caricature of me, and they both signed my chord chart, you know.
Really? Can we see it anyway? Is it on your website?
No, but I just moved not too long ago, and I got so much stuff that I haven't dug out for archive. I'm going to put it on my website, yeah.
That's fantastic.
So I showed up at the studio, you know, and Buddy Emmons, who you may or may not know, a great steel guitar player in Nashville, who was also there with me, and the rest of the band was Wings. So we kind of felt like, well, we got some camaraderie, you know, because we'd worked a lot together, so we kind of hung around each other, and I think we were both a little intimidated by the, you know, it's Paul McCartney, for goodness sake, you know. But we were both confident in our abilities. So anyhow, we learned the song. I don't remember. We recorded two songs, and I've not heard either of them released. I guess they're still in the can. No, that was the same project. But I think my understanding is he cut about 30 sides, maybe 25 or 30 sides.
Right,
I see. I don't know. That's just a number that somebody told me. So I don't know if that's factual. He may have only cut 15.
Right, right.
Or maybe cut 50. I don't know. But he was here for 3 months. So, but anyhow. So we write this first song down, and you know, I'm playing the piano, and Paul is sitting at the end of the piano, and the lid is up, you know, the piano. So I'm kind of looking through the piano like this, and I'm looking like I'm looking at you, and I'm got my phones on, and I'm grooving, and I look up, and here's Paul McCartney looking at me, playing bass and going, "Yeah, man, yeah." And I went, "Oh." I just kind of wilted, and he sensed it. You know, we got to the end of the take, and he sensed it, and he came over to me, and he said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah, man." I said, "You don't know what an honor it is." He said, "Oh, stop all that, man. Just play." He said, "We're here to have fun." And he said, "I'm just another bass player." He said, "Just do your thing." And he made it fine, and it was fine after that.
Fantastic.
He's a genuinely great guy.
How did you learn the songs? Were they off demos that he'd recorded, or did you jam it between the lot of you?
Yes, he knew some of the. I think he knew the number system, actually, as I remember. I don't know if he wrote the songs out, but I remember we were talking with him about the numbers, and every once in a while he'd throw a chord name like in the key of C, you know, C is one, of course. He'd say it's an E minor, or is it your three, or, you know, because he knew the theory. But as I recall, he dictated the song. I don't remember hearing a song or hearing the other song. We did two, but I don't remember hearing a demo of either one. I think he told us the chords and the numbers for them.
Tell us about, obviously, playing with Elvis. You did a tour with him in 76, I think it was?
Yes.
1976. You know, I've been umming and ahhing all week about how to approach this. I mean, I do think we need a bit of context in a timeline in Elvis's career then. Elvis passed away in August 77, I believe it was. So you played with him about 15 months before. But the previous 4 years before that, he'd had a kind of steady decline in his health, a lot of personal problems. He'd, his bodyguards raised concern about his reliance on prescription drugs and that kind of thing. Yet his response to that was to increase the amount of gigs he played. So I think he did 168 gigs in one of the years, but kind of between 73 and 77. What were your impressions of him beforehand and during the period when you played with him and then subsequently after?
Well, I mean, I knew of Elvis, I guess, from the time I knew about pop music. And I never thought that I would go on tour with him. Of course, nobody ever really plans on that. That's just one of those kind of things that happened. So when I got the call, and it was not a lot of notice. I think it was a month's notice or maybe a month and a half notice. I was flabbergasted, you know, because I hadn't done any live work since I had dedicated myself to being a studio musician. I decided, I ain't going to tour no more. I ain't going to live down a suitcase. I ain't going to heck with that. But all of a sudden, it's Elvis Presley, and I got a chance to work with Elvis Presley. I was highly complimented and flabbergasted that I had a chance to do it. I had not kept up with every record he'd released, but I kind of always knew about Elvis, you know, and his music and his legend. So we rehearsed in Graceland for 3 days.
Was he there for the time when you rehearsed, or did he have a musical?
Well, it was funny. We knew that he was in Graceland, but we didn't see him until the beginning of the afternoon of the third day. Larry London and I rehearsed with the regular band with James and Jerry and everybody in the band. Larry London and I were the new guys. So once we learned the show, which we learned in a couple of days, I think it was the third morning, somebody said, "Well, you know, Elvis wants to hear us today." We're like, "Well, we're ready, you know." So it was the afternoon, and he came out to the racquetball court, you know, that's where we were rehearsing. And we ran through maybe 4 or 5 songs and maybe one medley. And he looked up and he said, "They're ready. You guys are great. That's all we're doing." And we looked at each other, Larry and I looked at each other, and I said, like, "Yeah, that's fine, you know." So we felt like, well, if he believes in us, we believe in it too. You know, we can do it if he wants to. And it went like clockwork. With any live show, there's always a little ups and downs and stuff like that. And the first couple of shows were maybe a little bumpy in a couple areas. But overall, we were ready. And his music was, I want to say, predictable enough musically, you know, that we knew that we had charts, of course. We had shows, show books, and we had charts. And we knew, as long as we watched Elvis, as long as you could see Elvis, he kind of just told you everything you need to know about, you know, when to stop, what to do next. If you wanted to change a song, he'd turn around and say, you know, "We're doing this." That's as long as you could see him, you know.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street.
Preparation for this, I've listened to a number of concerts on that particular tour when you were playing with him, and it's obviously I'm only listening to the audio of it, but what always struck me is how he would begin a song seemingly without giving you guys any cue, and it almost like he was almost trying to catch you out. But are you saying that there were particular cues, or you know, how did you know that he was going to just break into Heartbreak Hotel or Teddy Bear is the other one? You just have to start playing it.
Well, yeah. As you know, there's a certain kind of intuition that you have when you really know a performer and his music and how he likes to sing and what his tempos are and, of course, his keys and all the vital components. The rest is, I think, is all emotion. It's all about the moment, you know. Teddy Bear is a good example. I'll tell you this story because this is probably the most embarrassing moment of my entire life. I don't know how far through the tour. It was probably half, but we were in Cincinnati at the Riverfront Stadium. I think it's a huge stadium, 75,000 to 80,000 people, sold out. And one of the medleys that we did had Teddy Bear as the second song. I think Heartbreak Hotel might have been the first song, and then Teddy Bear. And it's like you said, you know, he would just he would sing a line, and we'd know that the next line was where we're coming in and what key, and we'd just join him, you know. So on this particular medley, what he would do, he'd sing the first song, and he'd cut us off and stop, and then he'd talk to the crowd a little bit and get them kind of working, you know. And he did a couple of karate moves, a couple of kicks like that, and then when he'd throw his right hand out in a punch, all I had to do was see that right hand come out, and as a pianist, I'd go, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da for Teddy Bear. Really simple, as long as I could see him. Well, in this particular show, Charlie Hodge, I was sitting, sitting down, I always play sitting down. Charlie backed up, and Charlie was pretty big in those days. And all of a sudden, I couldn't see Elvis, and we'd already stopped the first song, and I know he's talking to the crowd because I can hear it on the audio, but I can't see him. And I'm freaking out because now he's been talking for about 5-10 seconds. I'm like, "Charlie, get out of the way, get out of the way." And Charlie said he couldn't hear me. I said it two or three times, you know, and he said he couldn't hear me. Finally, he took a couple of steps to his left, and there's Elvis glaring at me, you know, turned around with the microphone, just staring a hole in me, and I'm like, oh, Lord. And he said something like, excuse us, ladies and gentlemen, we got a new idiot playing piano back here that can't seem to follow directions or something like that. And all these people laughed at me.
Baby, let me be your loving teddy bear. Put a chain around my neck, lead me anywhere. Oh, let me be your teddy bear. Oh, don't want to be a tiger.
But, you know, Elvis was a funny cat. He was a joker, and he loved to play pranks on people. And after that, there got to be this little thing where he'd be in a different song in a different key, and he'd turn around and look at me and throw his right hand out, and I'd go, did it? It became a little game between us.
Excellent. That's a great story. Could you talk us through, Shane, how to prepare your preparations on really kind of high-profile gigs? I know you did one called Running for President, which was a football stadium. Or it was many, many thousands of people there. Did that faze you at all, playing in front of 70 or 80,000 people? Talk about your preparations through the day, or did it come quite naturally to you?
It came quite naturally to me. The thing that I would do to be prepared was more or less relax. I never used to have to warm up. Now I do. I warm up a little bit before sessions or gigs, but it was very natural. You know, I would get myself into the emotional space, I guess, for lack of a better word, of whether it was a big job or a small job, it was going to be music. You know, it didn't matter if we were playing for 100 people or 100,000. I got to play music. And the very fact of thinking about that would relax me and get me into a kind of a mode to perform. Because, you know, performing to me is all spontaneity, a framework that you have to conform to for a song, of course, but it's the emotion, you know, that's what it's about. And even if you're playing something that, you know, you're playing with somebody else or a solely part or something that's notated that you played 1,000 times, if the emotion is there, it's always fresh, you know. Get excited about it, I guess, is the best way to say it.
I'm proud to say that she's my little girl for me to love. I'm always your girl, uh-huh.
Obviously, I kind of touched upon the fact that he wasn't that well at the time. However, his voice was beautiful, and he we were kind of blessed, I suppose, as fans, that a lot of musicians who you know, as they progress through their career, and if they do have incidences where, you know, they do become unwell, that you know, their talent and their voice perhaps goes or deteriorates. But, you know, I've got examples of where he's still singing incredibly, you know, right up until before he passed away. How was he as a person with you? Did you tour, you know, when you were touring around the country with him, did he travel with you, or did you interact a lot, or was he quite removed from the rest of the guys?
No, he was not removed. We flew on the plane with him. A couple of times we had to go by bus, and I suppose he flew ahead, but that was just when there were so many people that we couldn't get everybody on the plane. But several, let's see, at least half the time we were on the plane with him, and he was right down to earth. He was not egotistical or overly bossy, but at the same time, you know, if you wanted something, he had the right to have it his way. I mean, he's paying for it. You know, he's a boss, whether you work for a construction boss or you work for a musical boss, the boss is paying you, and you do what the boss says. If you have a suggestion for something better, that's fine, you know. But I never saw any weirdity from him or anything. He was always very friendly to me. And traveling on the plane was just wonderful. It was a wonderful time.
And you recorded on the Promised Land album, is that right, as well?
Yes.
So was that before the tour?
Yes, actually, Felton Jarvis, you know, produced that, and Chip Young engineered and co-produced. I think Chip might be co-producer on that record, but I had been in Nashville not very long, and that's what actually got the gig for me. In my understanding was that Elvis heard some synthesizer and maybe some piano or something that I had done, and said, that's really good. You know, we're losing Glenn D. Who can we get? This guy's really good. You know, is he available, et cetera, et cetera. And David Briggs, of course, who was with Elvis for years and years, and a really good friend, actually recommended me for the job too with Felton. So that record and being in the studio group with the people in Nashville kind of both got his attention, I believe.
Can you think of anything you learned specifically from that time that could perhaps be passed on to other musicians or performers? You know, you've worked with one that, you know, the King. What could young musicians learn from your vantage point?
Well, I would say listening is the first thing that I was never a good listener early on. I would do what I was doing and play my parts, you know, and kind of halfway listen to whatever was going around me. But the more I listened to what other people were playing and what the other people were saying by what they were playing, the more it was conducive to me playing something that was more appropriate, you know, fitting better. So I would say the number one rule of any job, whether you're in the studio, but especially if you're live, is listen, listen, listen. Keep those ears open, you know. Try to hear everything that's, if you're in your ears, whatever, or if you're on the stage, if you got monitors, wedges, listen to what's going on around you, and especially with the artist or whoever. Sometimes the artist is not in charge of the stage. Sometimes it's a producer or a director, you know, depending on if it's television or not. But listening is the most important thing to do to me.
Good advice. And anything specific from Elvis as a performer? So if you're a young performer, a singer, anything you learned from him working with him?
Just giving it all you got, you know. When you're out there on stage, those people are paying a lot to see the act. And I think they're entitled to, you know, get 100% from anybody that's, you know, part of the band or part of the entourage. Give it 100%. Don't give it 99. Go for it. Here we go.
If I stay because you, my boy.
You're obviously a man of tremendous integrity, given that you didn't take the guy's job at the pizza parlor. There's another example of this, given that you actually had to tell Elvis that you weren't available to play with him because you were fulfilling a weekend away with your father, who was older at the time, and it was something you'd been doing since a young child. Is that right?
Well, not extremely. We've been doing it about 12 years at that point, or 13 years, and it was a whole week. We used to go for a whole week to the West Virginia mountains and camp out, you know, and hunt and do the guy, you know, the dad, father and son thing, you know. And it was, dad was pretty old at that point. His health wasn't failing, but, you know, we don't know. We're not guaranteed tomorrow. And it meant a lot to me. And I knew that he would understand. Something told me if I just told him what was going on, just told him the truth, you know, that there would be no problem. And he understood. He looked at me and said, "I understand," or something like that. He confirmed it, you know. And I could tell from the way he said it, he admired it, you know. And that's when he said, you know, "Would you be my first sub?" And I said, "Are you kidding?" I said, "I'm just sorry that I can't do this next year." And he said, "Well, I'm sorry I can't give you the job permanently, but I got to have somebody, you know, full-time for the next one." And I said, "I totally understand. Thank you for the opportunity to sub." But, of course, he was gone less than a year later.
Yeah.
Well, about a year later, I guess.
And what's your thoughts on his legacy now? You know, he's obviously still a huge presence in globally, as you know, his music is still played everywhere. What's your thought on his legacy now? I mean, you do, and your thoughts on the, obviously bands are touring now, who like Elvis's band and that kind of thing. How do you think he would have felt about that, and how do you feel about that?
I think he would encourage anybody who feels that music is their destiny to tour and perform live, because that's where it's all from. The records are the vehicles, the videos are the vehicles, but the live performing and consequently touring, you know, from live performing, that's really always been music, you know, from way before when it was recorded music. It was performing, you know, for people and expressing yourself musically. I think he would encourage anybody who really feels a call to that destiny to do it. And sometimes it's not comfortable. Sometimes you got to sleep in a station wagon, you know, or on the floor, you know, whatever. But if your heart is in what you're doing, It's not an expensive price to pay, you know.
What do you think about kind of these tours where his band are actually going out and playing with kind of a concert with him on a screen? Or you've even seen, I think it was on one of the American talent shows, where Celine Dion did a duet with his hologram and stuff like that. How do you feel about that kind of stuff? Do you think that's exploiting his brand and, you know, who he is? Or do you think he would have liked that or agreed with that?
My sense tells me that he would have liked it. It's technology. It's technology that didn't exist when he was alive, but that doesn't invalidate it, because it was technology that he used when his, you know, people before him weren't alive. I've done a couple of those big screen shows, and it's challenging because, you know, once the music starts, you don't stop.
Mm.
Shows are continual. You know, some of it's pre-recorded. We're playing live with a click, and we're playing with a video, and that video, as you, if you've seen those shows, the video doesn't stop, because if you stop the video,
the whole thing comes crumbling down. Yeah.
And the load is really on the drummer usually, because he has to listen to the click tracks and count it off, and he has to immediately segue from one song to another, from tempo to tempo. It's a lot of work and a lot of challenge, but it's fun to play. I think he would love it. I think he really would.
That's great to hear. Thanks for speaking about him in so much detail. I know you're only with him for a month or two, but it's obviously very interesting from a musician's point of view. You then went on and worked at Atlantic Records, and you kind of developed into more of a writer, producer, arranger, and you worked with the likes of obviously Ahmet Erdogan and Arif Mardin at different places. What did you learn from those kind of guys? Amazing producers.
Oh, amazing people. I had first met Arif when I joined Chips Moman's rhythm section in Memphis. It was the first time I met Arif and Danny O'Keefe. I don't know if you remember the Danny O'Keefe record, Good Time Charlie Has the Blues, but I didn't play on that single, but I played on that album, and Arif produced that album. And so when I saw Arif, I hadn't seen Arif for probably 15 years, and I saw him, I was working in New York, and we ran into each other in the studio. He didn't quite remember me until I reintroduced myself and reminded him about Memphis and Chips and Danny O'Keefe, and he said, "Oh yes, I remember you." And he named Reggie Young, who is a brilliant guitar player and a friend of mine. He asked me how Reggie was, and so we kind of got familiar. And then when I started working for Ahmet, I worked with Arif several times, five or six times on projects. Arif was inspirational in the studio. He was such a music person. You know, his brilliant concepts of rhythm and harmony and there'll never be another person like him. There are so many wonderfully talented people in the music business, but he had an exclusivity about him that was just amazing, and he was a sweet, well-mannered, refined person. Yeah, I really miss him. Ahmet was my mentor in the music business and the record business. I learned so much about the art of recording, I guess, because although I'd spent a great deal of time on the other side of the glass as a studio musician, I had spent not much time as a producer or arranger on the control room side of the glass, you know. And Ahmet taught me to take my musician's hat off and put my producer feel hat on. I remember the first time one of the first projects we did together, we were listening to takes, and I usually didn't play on the stuff that I worked with Ahmet on. He wanted me to be in the control room with him, you know, and listen and be objective about what was going on. So we were doing this project, and we'd done two or three takes, and we're listening to the takes back. And he said, "Which one of these do you like?" And I told him it was number two or number three. And he said, "Well, I like number two." And I said, "Why do you like it?" And he said, "Because of the way it feels." He said, "Listen to the way it feels compared to number three." And we listened to him, and he was right. It just, I couldn't tell you why, even trying to analyze it musically, but it felt better. Might have had a few little tiny mistakes in it, but it felt better. And that's so important in music, how things feel.
And since you've kind of developed into more of an arranger, you've obviously written some stuff for large-scale pieces of music, kind of some scores and some musicals, I believe. Where do you start with that kind of process? It's obviously so far removed from what you're doing as a pianist, as a young man, and playing rock and roll on the piano. With a blank sheet, where do you start?
I try to picture what they want, you know. If they hum me a melody, or they have a demo, or, you know, a recording of it, whatever, then I become kind of analytical about it. You know, I analyze the tempo, the key, the feel, the dynamics, everything I can about the mechanics of it. And I still like to write things on score paper. I have Sibelius, and I've got Pro Tools and Logic, and there's a great music program in Logic. And that's very useful as a device, but there's something about writing on a score, writing the notation down, that I still love. Now that may not be true for everybody. I'm not saying that, you know, that just happens to be something that I love. But I would say that the first thing to do is get the concept of what it is. Why are you doing this? Well, because it's pretty, or because it's exciting, because it's angry, because it's fast, whatever. Try to figure those factors out, and then take the emotions that come from those and translate that to music. I guess is
fantastic.
My methodology.
Thanks for that insight. It's that's great. And obviously, your recording career has spanned a period where working practices in studios has kind of drastically changed. How have you found kind of that evolution, and how have you found kind of the changes from kind of analog to digital, that kind of thing? What's your views on that?
Well, you know, I feel incredibly blessed because I've come from the time of when everybody was on the floor at the same time, you know, maybe 70, 80 people in the room, to one at a time, you know, which is the way a lot of records are made now, one instrument at a time. There is validity in both. What I feel is that you cannot make a record by recording an instrument one at a time sound like a band, because there are things that happen when 5, 6, 7 people or 25 or 30 people play together that are just, they just sound and feel differently than they're when they're done individually or in small groups of ones and twos. That's not to say that one sounds better or worse than the other. It doesn't necessarily mean that at all. I've heard incredible feeling and great records that were made one instrument at a time. I've made records myself and been part of records that started with a piano and a click track that were wonderful records. But, you know, the idea of being in part of an orchestra or part of a big rhythm section and making perfect takes, you know, where you could not punch in, that's, I'm not going to say it's a bygone art, because there's many, many people that are still capable of doing it, but that's not the norm now. In fact, I'll tell you a quick story about, there were records that were called direct-to-disc records. I don't know if you're familiar with that term. In the 80s, direct-to-disc record, let's see, was it the 80s or the late 70s? I think it was late 70s, back when vinyl was the medium. You'd have a room full of people, studio musicians or musicians, period, and the control room, you've rehearsed all the music, and you've got your music in front of you. Or, you know, if you don't have music, you know what you're going to play, and you know you're going to do one side of the record, 4, maybe 5 songs, without stopping. So you see the control room, and the control room goes, here we go. Engineer raises the fader, there's a count off, play the first song, get to the end, the fader goes down, you change your music, you got 5 seconds to change your music, control room goes, here we go, raises the fader up, count out the second song, et cetera, for one whole side of the record at a time.
Wow.
It was amazing. The fidelity for vinyl back then was unequaled because there was no tape in the way. We were cutting the lathe was the master record was being cut as we were recording it. So the fidelity was unequaled, but you couldn't make a mistake, and if you did, everybody has to start over.
I think that you can also, but it's interesting to hear you talk about this, but I think that you lose a bit of character these days compared to back then in some of the recordings. There's a good example on Hold On, I'm Coming, which was done in one take, famous Sam and Dave song, Stax, I believe. And you probably know this, but I think it's a trumpet player, or certainly a brass instrument. He doesn't realise it's a double chorus, and he comes out. And then he joins back in and starts Carry On Playing. And just little kind of bits like that, you lose a bit of character when you can just do take after take after take.
Records one thing at a time because of the amount of control that you can have, but that control can be dangerous. You can sterilize something if you're not very careful. You can make things perfect, and perfect is never good, you know. I don't think perfectly in tune is fine, but to me, tuning the human voice is, until it's perfect, is not fine. That's, I guess, my biggest gripe is pitch. And having perfect A440 pitch in records That was, we never heard that until what, about 2004, 2003, when the tuning modules became really useful. I remember when I owned a Synclav in the 90s, I've owned two systems, tuning vocals and going, well, it's perfectly in tune, but I sure don't like it. But that was not, sometimes it wasn't my job to don't like it or like it. I was just, you know, it was my job to do.
I think it's the use of it as well. So if you're tuning, if you're putting auto tune on to kind of cover up some mistakes, that's quite poor. Whereas obviously you do get some artists who use it as a kind of a tool, as a you know. But I know that if you listen to there's a McCartney album from about 10 years ago recorded in, I think it's called Good Evening New York City, and someone's whacked auto tune on that, and it just sounds awful, and he doesn't need to do it. It's interesting listening to you talk, because obviously you've played through a period where the recording styles, you know, you've seen a great evolution. However, when you started playing the Mini Moog, that was so drastic, compared to the stuff before, far more drastic than any of the changes that have happened in the last 10 years.
Oh, yeah, the Mini Moog changed my life. And I didn't pay much attention to electronic music, even though, you know, Wendy Carlos and... Well, I can't think of how many people, wonderful artists, were making electronic music. It was just kind of another medium to me at that point. Yeah. But when the Mini Moog came out, I was hired in 1970 or 71 by a producer from a group called the Harmonicats, Pete Peterson, who was working for Pepper. Tanner called me one day and he said, "Hey, for the session tomorrow, I want you to play the Mini Moog." And I said, "What's a Mini Moog?" He said, "It's a synthesizer. It's a portable synthesizer." Because until then, they looked like switchboards, you know, with one keyboard, you know, and you had a million patch cords, and they were very unstable. So I showed up, and here's this Mini Moog, you know, small keyboard, portable, and sounded awesome. I bought one the next day. I was amazed with them. I was amazed because I realized here's an electronic music source that is portable.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working.
In Nashville, we do a lot of different kinds of music and always have. And that's one of the things that I love about Nashville. You might do a country record in the morning, and you might do a pop record in the afternoon. You might do a Christian record the next morning, et cetera, et cetera. But I remember, I don't know if you remember the Michael Johnson records, Bluer Than Blue and Almost Like Being in Love, and those records. Well, I played on those, and I don't remember which exactly record it was, but I'm pretty sure it was Almost Like Being in Love, or else it was either that or Bluer Than Blue, that we recorded in the morning. And that night I recorded either Take This Job and Shove It or The Perfect Country Song, one or the other. But I remember it was one of those days when the music was just like from one extreme to the other, all in a 12-hour period. That's things that happen, you know, in the world of studio musicians that I like to believe it's not a bygone era. I hope that the amount of work one day will be that again, for so that people can be full-time studio musicians. But gosh, you know, in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, the volume of work was 3 and 4 sessions a day, every day. If you were careful and slept enough, that was the thing, you know. You could do, I remember the first year I did 800 sessions in 1 year.
Wow. 800?
800 in 1 year. I don't know if I ever did it again, because that was my goal, to do an 800 session year. I probably might have done it one more time, I don't know. But the three of us one day, Reggie Young, marvelous guitar player, Larry London, a drummer you might know,
yep,
and I were, we were all eating lunch, and I think it was a Tuesday morning or a Wednesday morning. It was during the week, and it was lunchtime, you know, it was like 1:30, and we were working together. That's why we go to lunch, and we realized that we were all so tired. We were just physically tired because we were just tired. And somebody says, "Why are you tired?" "Well, I worked 4 sessions yesterday and worked 4. Yeah, so did I. What can we do?" And somebody said, "Well, what if we charged double scale and we lost half of our clients? We'd be working half as much and making the same amount of money." Pretty good idea, but would anybody hire us? Well, if half our clients don't call us back and half do, what about if we go charge double scale and 3/4 of our clients don't call us ever again? We are making half of our present income. Can we live on half of our income? And we all said, "Yeah, I could live on half of my income. I'd see my family more. I'd have more time for myself." So we all three decided to go double scale and take the risk, and we called all of our clients. We all called everybody in our books and said, look, the reason we're doing this is because I show up on Monday morning for your session and I'm tired. I don't want to be tired for your session. I want to be fresh. And everybody understood. And for a while, the work dropped off for the three of us. But in about 6 or 7 months, we were turning down work, you know.
So without much more ado, we bid you an affectionate farewell. Okay, take it off.
Wise men say, only fools want fresh air. Oh, I guess falling in love, yeah. Shall I
say? As a young musician, I remember just being interested in playing music. It didn't matter if it was recording, although I loved the challenge of the recording studio more than anything, because the challenge of doing a, quote, perfect job, you know, was always something that I really enjoyed, the pressure, and taking direction from the producer or the artist or getting feedback from the other musicians. And the camaraderie of that, you know, that's something that as a young musician, I always strive to be the best that I could be at it. What's left for me now is probably the most exciting part of my life, because I've never done a record of just what I wanted to do. I've never taken the time. I've wanted to several times, but I've always kind of backburdened it. So I'm going to make some recordings over the next. This is the studio that I'm building right now. Not quite done, but
it looks fantastic.
Well, thanks. I've got the gear that I wanted, and it's going to be a nice place to work. It's in the basement of my home. So over the next 2 years, I'm going to start doing music of my own. It's something, like I said, that I've kind of backburned, and I thought, well, it's time for me to do this, or it's not going to get done. So, Lord willing, and the creek don't rise, you'll have some audio to hear from me in a few months.
Great. We'll look forward to that. Okay, we'll wrap up. I mean, you've had such an incredible back catalogue of work. We really appreciate your insight today on the Stage Left podcast. You've played on records that will be listened to and enjoyed for many, many years. And if I may say so, way after you and I were gone. And that's a legacy you should be very proud of. I want to thank you for being with us today on the Stage Left podcast, Shane. Where can we find out more, you know, when you are going to be releasing stuff in the future? What's your website address?
ShaneKeister.com.
Fabulous.
Chris, I want to thank you very much for your interest in my career, because it's been a crazy life, you know, and a very blessed career, but I thank you for your interest in it.
Good stuff. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for your interest, and thanks for having me. I appreciate it, Chris.
Burn in love, baby.
Lord Almighty, I feel my temperature rising. Yeah, higher, higher, it's running through.